Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. Environmental journalists are playing a critical role in helping us understand the climate crisis and human-caused climate change. On today's One Planet series, we are joined by four environmental journalists, including three who are going to UC Berkeley's J School, who have spent time in the Philippines and Panama chronicling how communities have come up with creative ideas to tackle the crisis. Today's guests, Sarah Trent, traveled to the Philippines to document how a community of mostly women set up a system to monitor a marine reserve, which is critical to maintaining a sustainable population of fish. Hi, Sarah. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Nisha Balram. Nisha went to Panama to report on a woman rancher, which I understand is a rarity, and we'll learn about that, who is pursuing pastoral ranch practices and raising cattle, which is more ecologically harmonious and less greenhouse gas intensive than neighboring cattle farms. Hi, Nisha. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Allison Stamos went to the Philippines to report on a program started by parents who are producing organic vegetables and fruits for rural schools while big industrial farms falter under climatic pressures. Hi, Allison. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
And we are joined by Mark Shapiro, an award-winning investigative journalist, a lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, and the author of several books, including his most recent, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. And Mark has been on our show twice to talk about this book, Seeds of Resistance. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Mark. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, great to be back.
Well, Mark, we came up with the idea for the show when you were last on talking about Seeds of Resistance, because you were telling me about the school that you're, the class that you're teaching at the UC Berkeley J School, and the interesting project where students are actually going overseas to find out how communities are tackling the climate crisis. Can you tell us about that project?
Yeah. I co-teach a class with James Fawn at the School of Journalism at Berkeley, and it's called Earth Journalism. And the idea is to actually teach the fundamental elements of the environment and how to report on them, deeply grounded in both the science and the essence of what some of the environmental challenges are today. So I do remember our talk, Rose, and it's so cool because actually one of the things I noticed during this class, which occurred in the spring, was how many of the students in this class actually went out and reported on responses to environmental and climate challenges. And that actually really struck a note with me, and that's what I think was the genesis of this class. These three here, Alice and Nisha and Sarah, all went out to different far-flung parts of the world to actually report on these responses. There were others also in the class. It was actually very striking after years of doing environmental journalism myself and now teaching it, how these journalists here amongst us and others in the class were interested in the kind of responses to these conditions. And so I think perhaps it signifies some kind of change. I'm not sure yet, mm-hmm. but we're trying to educate people in how to actually document, chronicle, expose the underlying environmental challenges we now face.
And Mark, just a couple general questions about environmental journalism, and I'd love you all to also weigh in on this. You're a longtime environmental journalist, Mark. You've written a couple of books about these issues. What are your overall thoughts right now about the state of environmental journalism? I'm thinking about Inside Climate News, for example. The major papers are trying to ramp up their news about the climate crisis. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think actually there is a rising consciousness that we actually have to deal with this environmental crisis that's hitting at us from many different directions. Of course, climate change hangs over everything and is altering conditions all across the planet. And within my class, I kind of organize it in according to subject matter, all of which arises out of these questions. So, for example, we deal with biodiversity. What is it? What's happening to the biodiversity of animals and plants and organisms on the planet? What are the threats to the public health? How are we going to continue growing food in these highly stressed circumstances. And I think that these issues are – I can see it in the media. I can actually see it. I think there's a much higher attention because it's kind of coming at us from every direction. And now even – I think there's even a change in wording. You just use it yourself. Climate change has actually evolved to being climate crisis mm-hmm. as a way to acknowledge the seriousness of these challenges. And we're trying to evoke that, of course, in the class and also in the journalism that people are doing.
And why did you all decide to pursue environmental journalism? Why did you decide to take that route? Allison or Nisha, go ahead.
The one thing that strikes me about environmental journalism is it's so interconnected. And I know my story, as well as my colleagues' stories, it was much more than just, you know, for example, raising cattle. It was about how do you heal the land? How does this mom want something better for her community? And I think that the state of, you know, just talking about the environment, you're talking about something very universal that we all experience. Not only is it a biome, but we're in a global market, and everything that one person does affects the other. I just wanted to say, just in terms of climate resiliency, I think we're all in the struggle together. But the trend that I'm seeing now is that we're looking for solutions. You know, how can we be creative and support each other in this?
You know, for me, getting into environmental reporting started something pretty fundamental. It was when I became a mom and, you know, you get pregnant and everyone gives you these books and it says, don't eat this, toxic that, you know, protect your body, protect your kids. And then all of a sudden, my eyes were opened. And we live in the Bay Area, so I thought my eyes were open. But when you start hearing about all these things, you know, because the high levels of mercury, well, if it's not okay when I'm pregnant, why is it not? Why is it okay after I'm pregnant? And so it sort of opened up all these questions for me, and that's sort of how I started down this path of environmental reporting. But it's funny when we call it environmental reporting. To me, all these stories, there is crime, there is health care, there is politics involved. So it's always funny how we segment these environmental stories mm-hmm. as something so separate, but really it's really, I think, woven into all the things that are sort of top of mind that we have, that we think about every day.
Mm. Good point.
Yeah, I'll agree with what Allison just said. I think environmental stories relate to literally everything that we have going on. I came to journalism school thinking I wanted to be a business reporter, but have spent the last 10 years working in food systems, working with entrepreneurs, and just there's so much interconnection with all of these topics. Actually taking this class with Mark really showed me, like, no, I have to be an environmental reporter. This is at the core of everything that I care about and everything that I'm doing. Mm.
And frankly, just to be, I mean, maybe I'm a little biased here, but I think in the environment is the biggest story of our generation. And we're different generations, me, Sarah, and Nisha, but it's just really this idea. I really think this is the important story of our time. There's no question.
And so it's so interesting to hear you all talk. I'm so happy that we're all here today because usually we're in a classroom and now we're in our cool radio studio here at KLW. And hearing you guys talk and then just thinking about this, I think there's a reason why the class is actually called Earth Journalism. Hmm. And in a way, that's what all of you were talking about, and that's in a sense what we're talking about, is that there's been this kind of, in a sense, a kind of a false separation of, quote, environmental reporting itself doesn't really capture the fullness of this kind of journalism. And when you think about it as Earth Journalism, we're actually reporting on the state of the Earth, which has all these ramifications, both in the ecological conditions and the disruptions, but that trickles down into the equity questions and the public health matters and the stability of our economic and political systems. This is essentially about the Earth and the ecological systems that sustain us.
And I also, before we dive into your projects, another general but important question. Mark, maybe you can take this one first. As a co-teacher of this class, Earth Journalism, how do you contextualize where we are right now? Because before the show, we were saying, I don't like calling the administration climate deniers because they know exactly what's going on. It's just that they don't want to make the changes needed because it will hit profits. That's just a fact. I mean, look at the people running the EPA and the people in the administration are from industry. So you've got that going on. And then you've got climate refugees. Just last week, Andrew Wheeler, the EPA administrator, and I'm reading from The Guardian right now, announced that despite what independent scientists say, chlorpyrifos is going to continue being used. And we know that it causes neurodevelopmental damage in children, and it's going to be still applied by farmers to foods that we all regularly eat. And so there's so much happening right now, Mark. What a time to be a professor, a lecturer, focusing on these issues. How do you bring that into the classroom?
Well, I think you bring in the connection of all these phenomena. So we've tended to separate, for example, the condition of the EPA. We've considered the climate change is kind of one thing out there, whereas, in fact, they're all connected. And I think one of the emphasis of the class and one of the emphasis of my own writing and reporting on this is to show the connectedness of these various forces. So, for example, climatic disruptions are directly linked to the immigration crisis we have on the border here in California. I mean, when you look at where those migrants are coming from, they are coming from parts of southern Mexico and also Guatemala and other Central American countries that have been hit viciously with the climatic shifts that are taking place, no longer able to sustain themselves on the land, and so they come north, which gets you directly into matters of equity because, of course, it's the United States that's a major contributor to greenhouse gases that are affecting people who had very little contribution to those greenhouse gases. So if anything, I think we'll call them earth journalists, even though the normal way or the contemporary way to reference is environmental journalism, but I kind of prefer the term of earth journalists, are actually looking at the connectedness of all these different forces. And I would say one of the big emphasis of teaching, but also of my own journalism and also trying to pass it along, is the importance of understanding the basic science of ecological questions. And so we do emphasize that in the way we teach, and of course the way I write and my colleague James Vaughn writes, is basically to ground our reporting in science. The reason we know what's happening on the earth now is because scientists are telling us. They're out there in all these different forms actually telling us the stresses created by climate. What happens when you lose a species and the cascade of impacts that happen on down the line? And so I think it's getting more and more and more important to actually understand the fundamentals of science in order to basically have the material you need to actually go and do this kind of journalism.
Can I say, I think it's really interesting because when you go to report, I think Mark's right that you need to have it as a journalist to have this grounding, because then you go and report and you're in the Philippines and farmers don't talk about climate change. They talk about how many sacks of rice did they produce this harvest, mm-hmm. right? So they don't use those terms. But I think as journalists, it's important for us to contextualize, right, to use the individual experience and contextualize it in the larger picture. So I guess that's a plug for your class, Mark.
so.
No, but I mean, I really do believe strongly that there is, you know, there is this people are so concerned today about journalists who just sort of fly in and fly out. But right. to really ground yourself, I mean, we spend months preparing for our trips. We pitch on the first day and we spend months refining, because the idea is to really understand the environment that you're walking into, both literally and figuratively and politically, frankly.
Mm. I just want to say that I'm going to plug Mark's class a little bit, too.
This is good for Mark today.
Wow.
Just going off, you know, Allison got it right. You know, we learn, you know, I've had the general intuition, you know, we need to talk to scientists, as, you know, as journalists, to have the facts right, to make sure everything is super specific, and also not to over-exaggerate. I think there's a lot of doom and gloom in the media right now. And so it's like, what's accurate? How do we keep it relatable? And we had a lot of scientists that came into our classroom saying, hey, we're here with the information. We really want to create a network and have a collaboration with you, but we don't know who to reach out to or how to get it from that kind of legalese, quote-unquote, scientific language into something that people actually care about. So I feel like that's kind of at the point we are right now. Like, how can we go beyond the glaciers are melting and say, hey, like, what communities on the ground are affected by it? Is their food supply cut off? And I think just, you know, also what Allison said about a bag of rice, people who find their way to climate change resilience don't always find it willingly. They're like, oh, I need to have more profit on my farm. Let me try this thing. And it also includes a lot of risk. And I think if we tell stories of personal struggle and risk and how it's not always easy, but we all share common bonds, I think that's a really good way in which earth journalism can take that first step.
And thinking what Mark was saying about grounding our work in the science, I think it's more important actually to like step in the other direction and ground our work in not in the science and the stories of people on the ground. I mean, I may have gone to the Philippines to write about women protecting their fish, but like the same things are happening here. We just don't see it. Our food systems are threatened. Our cities are threatened. I find it really fascinating to go to these places around the world to see what's happening there, but think about, like, we may not be seeing it yet here in Oakland, but it's coming for us.
That is Sarah Trent. She traveled to the Philippines to document how a community of mostly women set up a system to monitor a marine reserve. Allison Stamos went to the Philippines to report on a program started by parents who are producing organic vegetables and fruits for rural schools. And Nisha Balram went to Panama to report on a woman rancher pursuing pastoral ranch practices and raising cattle. We're also joined today by Mark Shapiro, an award-winning investigative journalist, a lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, and the author of many books, including his most recent, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. And today we are talking about earth journalism. I like that, earth journalism, with three students at UC Berkeley who are earth journalists. And if you have any questions for our guest today about the state of earth journalism, environmental journalism, we will dive into their projects in just a couple minutes. But what are your thoughts on the state of earth journalism? Every Monday, we talk about issues that we're all mentioning today because we knew that after the election, most of the media or a lot of the media would focus on the tweets, and that's exactly what's happened. And so we decided to spend one day, at least a week, on these issues. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's dive in and talk about your projects. Allison, you mentioned this earlier, just the process of pitching your story and coming up with the ideas. Can you talk more about that? Because there's so much. How did you decide where you wanted to travel and what you wanted to focus on?
Well, for me, you know, I have a friend who'd been long talking about this program based out of New York City and Manila based. And so I feel like, you know, unlike others who've kind of gone through many iterations, I feel like I was always trying to do this story. It was about, and it's funny because it didn't start out as a climate story. It started out as a woman in New York who grew up, who has connections to the Philippines, who wanted to go and feed kids. And so she creates a lunch program. Okay, but then as I started to dig in, and half my background, my mother is from the Philippines, as I started to dig in, I realized that there was all this climate background to it. And that was what was so interesting. Why are farmers' kids in the Philippines hungry? How does that happen? And then when I started to dig in, and what we did was over the course of time, tease out the story. And that's sort of how you pitch it, is like at the heart of it, it's a struggle for parents to simply feed their kids. And in the background, there was the climate. So what is the story about? In the Philippines, one out of four children skip meals every single day. So we're talking 1.5 million kids go a whole day without eating. 75% of the Philippines is rural. So how does that add up, right? And Mark kept saying, I don't understand how farmers' kids are hungry. Well, as it turns out, in the Philippines, you've got these rice fields. And once upon a time, a rice field could give a family income, but it also could produce fish. It could also have vegetables, and so the families could eat. Then the Green Revolution, which happened in the Philippines, was this idea that we're going to give lots of pesticides to everybody. We're going to increase yields, right? So harvest goes up. But in the Philippines, what ended up happening is that in the farms, at least where we went to, the rice yields go up, but then you can't grow the fish. You're not growing vegetables anymore. And then you've got climate change. So you've got extreme weather conditions in the last few years. So not only you only have rice, you're not making enough money, then it's even harder to harvest the rice. And then what happens? You don't have enough money to provide for all your needs and to have your feed your kids. So the woman that I visited she had gone there and she thought, oh, let me help the kids in the schools by just giving them money to put a roof over their heads, as we sort of have this third world view of what countries, you know, what kids need in these schools. But they told her kids aren't coming to school because they're hungry. So the long story, and it's a very complicated long story, this former debt banker from New York City decided to build an entirely new revenue stream for the families. They had been growing, some of them had been growing organic vegetables in their gardens. And so she said, the school will only have organic vegetables, and we will feed every kid, and we will buy from the parents, and therefore create an entirely new revenue stream. And now the parents have all these organic vegetables that go straight into the schools. So you see how it started as, like, kids are hungry, and then you start to peel back the layers. And this is kind of what we've talked about, right? How all behind all these stories is a healthcare, it's a hunger, it's a food system issue.
Right. And there are so many elements to what you just said. When you're talking about the Green Revolution, we've done a lot of shows about that. And Mark wrote about it in his book, and how these governments sign deals with pesticide companies, even though the people don't want them. In many cases, they have no choice but to use these pesticides, and it does nothing to benefit the local people.
And then you get it, they've all gotten into a cycle, right? So they use the pesticides, and then they have a bad season. And then we actually went out to visit Erie out in the Philippines, and they're working on more drought-resistant strains of rice. And they're working on all kinds of things, because then you think you need to put more in, or you need something different. Whereas in some ways, the person that I worked with, she said she's gone back to native rice. She's tried to find some of these more indigenous rice that are just very simple and really are growing just as fine. So it's very interesting.
Can you repeat the numbers, the number of children that are going hungry in the Philippines?
1.4. So 75% of the population lives in rural areas. One out of four children skip meals, and about 1.5 million go a whole day without eating.
Wow. A whole day.
Yeah. So this lunch-based program that we talked about, it is the most complete meal that they'll have all day. And, you know, we were talking earlier, well, why do people locally, why should they care about it? And I thought about, say, Oakland. Right, where roughly 75% of Oakland students are on free and reduced lunch. So what if somehow the Oakland School District, or even just one school, said, we will feed all the kids with a protein and vegetable-based lunch every day, we're using only the vegetables that we buy from the parents? I mean, that's actually revolutionary if you think about it. I just got the goosebumps. I mean, you know, it's just thinking about, you know, the kids in Oakland schools and how much they don't, you know, I've heard them complain about the kinds of foods that they're getting. So, you know, I know there's a lot of projects that we want to talk about, but to me, there's this really deep connection of how a community can start to solve its problems. So it's, you know, the program, she comes in for 3 years, helps them get it going, and then the parents just run with it on their own. So they're not telling, it's not this colonial idea of coming in and telling us, this is how we're going to solve your problem. It's, well, what do you want to solve? Okay, my kids are hungry. That's problem one. Mm-hmm. And then they can start solving other problems.
How much time were you able to spend there?
How much time did I spend, or how much did I want to spend? So I think in total it was 6 days on the ground. So I did a video story. So it was six solid days of shooting. And I had a friend in New York who's a journalist who joined me, who also was working on a story for a New York-based magazine show, so called Asian American Life. So it was 6 days in Capiz. So you fly to Manila, then you fly to Rojas City, and then you take a bus. And so it was a lot. And there were some places where I was pretty sure that I was the only Westerner that they'd seen, or at least of not full Filipino blood, right? Mm. So the most interesting thing also is that these kids are all smiling. And when I came back, some of my classmates saw my video and they said, you're doing this piece on hunger and all these kids are smiling. And I said, well, they're Filipino. We just smile and we just get on with it, right? And that was like one of the cultural nuances that I could pick up, because it's true. I have a teacher telling me kids are eating coffee for breakfast or drinking coffee for breakfast, and that's all they could have. Or they're sleeping in class, and she's saying, why are they sleeping? And she can't help but she sort of got a smile on her face, because I think she's like thinking about how she's helping the kids too, and just sort of kind of being upbeat about it in spite of all these things around them. So
before the break, Nisha and Sarah said that they are still finding places for their stories. What about yours? Where can we see your video and read your story?
So I'm still also working on a place. I do know that because my video has been, I produced and produced this video for the show in New York, in Asian American Life, it'll certainly air. It'll air in New York City in September for their premiere show. And then also it will be available at stations around. So we can certainly put that link up.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
And that is Allison Stamos. She went to the Philippines to report on a program started by parents who are producing organic vegetables and fruits for rural schools. Allison is also a student at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. We're also joined by Sarah Trent and Nisha Balram, and we will hear about their projects after a break. Mark Shapiro is an award-winning investigative journalist and a lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. We are talking about his class, Earth Journalism. Mark is also author of many books, including Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. This is Your Call's One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Wad Al-Khatib and Edward Watts will join us to talk about their award-winning documentary, For Sama. It's a first-person perspective of the uprising in Aleppo, and it's a love letter from a young mother to her daughter. I hope you can join us for that. The film was made by Wad Al-Khatib. She's a 26-year-old Syrian filmmaker. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show with our panel of Earth journalists, if you have any questions for them or any comments about the state of environmental journalism today, we'd love to hear from you. Actually, I will also ask you about this later in the show, but a number of climate activists are putting the pressure on the Democratic National Committee to have a specific debate specifically about the climate crisis. So what are your thoughts just about the state of environmental journalism? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by Mark Shapiro, an award-winning investigative journalist and lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. His most recent book is Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. We had Mark on twice to talk about the book, and you can find the interview at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by three Earth journalists who are also studying at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, Sarah Trent, Allison Stamos, and Nisha Balram. And before we talk about other projects, let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Elliot in San Francisco. Hi, Elliot. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. The UN has issued a report this month that weather emergencies are occurring weekly now. And 2 weeks ago, we saw 7 feet of hail fall in the middle of Guadalajara. And crucially, this winter, the flooding in the Ohio River has, according to agronomists, caused significant loss of topsoil that would take decades to replace. And, of course, there's the likelihood of further flooding next year. So really what that flooding represents in the Ohio is a loss of one of the three major breadbaskets in the U.S. or a major degradation of it. And since that will continue year on year, we're seeing major impacts, you know, in the most developed country in the world on our food system. And so it becomes a survival issue. So I understand the necessity to discuss how people are adapting and to be positive, but isn't it also necessary to look at the more apocalyptic implications to try and spur meaningful political action?
Well, thank you for that. And when you were talking about the flooding in Ohio, I was thinking about the flooding in South Asia, and I just did a quick search. This was 4 days ago. CNN reported that more than 100 have died and 6 million are affected by flooding across South Asia. What about his point, Mark?
First of all, thank you for your call and very powerful point. And I think this just gives you a little bit of a taste of the impact of the extreme events that we're seeing actually all around the world. The flip side of extreme events is actually the lack of rain. On the one hand, you have the excess of rain. On the other hand, you have the heat, the rising temperature, and the droughts, which actually over time contribute to incredible excess of water in the atmosphere that then comes down and floods. So we have to understand both parts of that dynamic. And, you know, I just spent some time in the Central Valley over the last couple of months, and very similar pressures, though the other side of what you've just described, which is essentially the extreme drought and rising temperatures, are really threatening this breadbasket in the middle of California. So I think we need to be thinking on both levels. On the one hand, identifying some of these very disruptive forces and doing what we can to pressure our state, local, national governments. God knows we have trouble on the national level and international level. And at the same time, it used to be a bad word to talk about adaptation, a bad word only in the sense that people thought we're talking 5 years ago in the course of the climate debate, that talking too much about adaptation would get people away from actually how we're going to reduce greenhouse gases. And now we're at the point where I think we have to deal with both. We are in the middle of a climate crisis, as you've indicated, with the flooding that you mentioned, sir, and that Rose mentioned, South Asia. And we actually have to be thinking on both levels. And the final thing I would like to say about that is the stories we're talking about here that are global in nature, and we'll go with, you know, we got the Philippines and Panama, are the same things that are happening right here in our country. These journalists have found powerful stories to tell about what's happening overseas. We're not excluded from those. Those are not some exotic locales where these things are happening, affecting other people. Similar stories are unfolding right here in our own country. And
To Elliot's question, what are your thoughts on this? Because when you think about the politics of all of this, there's massive corruption in so many countries, even deals that are out for the public to see between the oil industry, for example, and governments. And Mark, you wrote a piece for The Guardian just recently about environmentalists who are being killed for their work in many parts of the country. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that over the last 10 years, an unprecedented 13 journalists pursuing environmental stories have been killed in the process of doing their work. So what are your thoughts about making the connections between what we're seeing on the ground and the lack of political action and also the corruption between industry and governments?
I don't have an answer to that specifically. I just was thinking back to what the caller said. He called this moment apocalyptic. And I think it's a mistake to only think about it as the apocalypse. I mean, yes, we're in a moment where we can't change. I mean, where we can maybe keep it to 2 degrees instead of 4 degrees. But in order to get there, we have to also be seeing what people are doing and not just, like, when you think about the apocalypse, all you can do is either ignore it or like retreat into like self-protection. And I think finding inspiration in what people are doing, the ways that communities all over the world are coming together to fight for the things that they need, like these women in the Philippines who recognize that the only way that they can protect their food supply is to protect these like little 2-acre plots of reef outside their backyards. Yeah, I think it's important to think, to hold the apocalypse and to hold the solutions at the same time. I think it's a mistake to only hold one or the other.
I just wanted to say, while my story was specifically in Panama, in terms, I can get into it later, of course, but these models, you know, exist in a bubble. And what we've seen in Panama, we've also seen in Missouri and in Colombia. So when people are inspired by creative thought, it spreads. And I just also think about political will. The farmers that I followed don't necessarily have the huge amount of political power to lobby their government to help support sustainable ranching. And so I think that these stories are also an example of the public moving towards something. And I feel that even if it's a transition or in stages, it's still moving towards an end goal, and we can't discount that.
And both all three of these have been dealing with these responses. And Anisha was in Panama. Sarah was in the Philippines, and you have citizens. They're experiencing stress. They don't know what to, you know, they may not, like Allison said, be able to call it climate stress, but it's certainly stress on the environment that they rely on to live. And that's why I think their stories have been so powerful, is how these people are organizing themselves and finding practices that are far more ecologically harmonious and protective of their own sources of sustenance, in a way. And that's where a lot of power comes now.
Right.
The question is a good one and provocative on some level, because there is accountability. And, you know, for every municipality in the world that makes a decision one way or another, is it banning plastic bags or is it something much deeper? You know, who are they in bed with that they're allowing to build? You know, one of our classmates went down to Cancer Alley down in Louisiana. And how did that happen? Right. So there's a lot of important, certainly in the United States. I mean, our public records laws vary from state to state. As an investigative reporter, I think about that a lot. And where can we find the information that really holds these governments accountable for the choices that they're making?
Well, thank you for the call, Elliot. Let's go next to Sonia in Berkeley. Hi, Sonia. Welcome to the show.
Oh, my goodness. I can't believe that I'm listening to something about my home country, which doesn't get a lot of coverage, even though we were colonized by this country when it first became an imperial power in 1898. I was born there, and I've lived here for some time now, and I follow the news because I do study the climate, although I don't do it for research. My late grandfather, my father's father, was an eggplant farmer in Zambales, in his hometown. And so anytime I hear anything about farming in the Philippines, my ears really prick up. I listen to a lot of things, but this one really grabbed me today. Thank you so very much for covering this. My brother is a geologist who travels from Wisconsin, where he lives in a permaculture area, to our home country to cover what's going on. Right now he's fighting what they want to do to resurrect the Bataan nuclear power plant, which was built on an earthquake fault at the behest of the late unlamented Marcos. And so he's fighting tooth and nail to get that thing resurrected because we don't need that to add to the climate problems we already have. Hmm. Yeah. Drought and flood, either too much or too little water. It's none of it's any good. And I'm very happy that the problems in other parts of the world are being connected and interpreted in light or dark of what's happening here. Hmm. Seeing all these fires in wet spring, dry summer, fall fires, and it's becoming a pattern, which is really unnerving.
Yes.
Thanks so much, Rose, for all your good work. I listen to you a lot, and I'm really, really grateful for your covering this.
Oh, thank you so much for calling in, Sonia. And again, before we go to Sarah's project, Allison, since Sonia is from the Philippines, you talked about where we might be able to see the video. Are you also going to write a report?
I mean, there's a lot to say about what's happening. So it is something, you know, the challenge of being a student sometimes is that you're cranking, and a journalist is you're cranking, and I'm already working on another investigation. But I have thought about it quite a bit, and actually, we've been applying for documentary funding. Mm-hmm. My partner in New York, she has applied for at least 3 grants so far. So if anybody wants to fund us digging in, because there's video and there's print. And the video, I think, really brings back to the beauty and really takes you there. There are a lot of journalists who travel, no disrespect to my print partners, but to be able to bring a camera on the ground and really be able to, like, hear of the rice and know what it feels like when it sounds really dry, and that bring that to life, and really trace back the roots. So that's kind of where we're going with this. Thank you for asking.
Yes, of course. So, Sarah, why don't we talk about your project next? You travel to the Philippines to document how a community of mostly women set up a system to monitor a marine reserve, which is critical to maintaining a sustainable population of fish.
Yep.
Why did you decide to go to the Philippines and focus on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, so I worked with my colleague and classmate, Rosa Tuiron, who is a video journalist who is really interested in underwater stories. And my interest is really in food systems. And so we found a story that was both of those things. We were also really interested in the issue of gender and how gender is affecting or related to conservation all over the world. And we found, yeah, like you said, that these groups of women have really stepped up to manage marine protected areas in a country that has largely failed to do so. There are a lot of marine sanctuaries in the Philippines. There's like 1,500 of them, but most of them are considered paper parks that they exist, but they're not actually being managed or protected or enforced effectively.
Right. So the paper park means there's no money to actually protect it, and then no enforcement, right?
Yeah, it's on a map,
yeah.
But that's about it. So we met women like Evelyn Malachi, who is just total superhero on the island of Sikihor, who has literally been shot at trying to protect the sanctuary in her backyard. Because she knows that the only way to protect food security for future generations, and I think in many ways women are thinking about future generations in a way that the men who are out fishing or, you know, bringing home the bacon or the fish or whatever, aren't, they're not in that mindset. So she and women like her are just fiercely protecting these fish and the reefs from illegal fishing. So our story, my story and Rosa's story, is about the island of Sikihor. It's about these heroes like Evelyn Malachi and what it really takes and the community that it requires to protect food systems, natural resources, in the face of a government that hasn't been doing a whole lot.
So she's been shot at?
She has been shot at, yes. She, I mean, she has a bunch of stories. She lives basically on the beach. The marine sanctuary that she protects is in her backyard. There's this hut behind her house where all night people in her community just sit in the hut and watch the sanctuary, looking for lights, looking for any indication that people are fishing illegally in the sanctuary. And she has, on a number of occasions, seen somebody out there and just gone into fight mode and literally, like, rowed her kayak out into the sanctuary. She had one illegal fisher shoot at her with a spear gun, and it missed. It just barely. It was, like, attached to, like, a 3-meter-long rope, and if it hadn't been on that rope, it would have hit her. And she goes out there, and she fights for it because she's thinking about future generations and, like, without people like her protecting this area, it will just be famine.
What is the state of fish right now in the Philippines, in this particular area? Because we've done so many shows about how the fish population is just drastically declining around the globe.
Yeah, so we went out with some fishermen who were fishing one night at sunset, and we watched them pull in their nets and pull in, like, one, you know, those blue water jugs? So they had cut off the top of a jug and were filling it with fish. They filled almost one whole jug with fish. 10 years ago, they would have filled 10 of those with fish. Wow. And it was a good night that we saw. It was like 10 to 15 kilograms of fish,
It brings up so many issues around desperation. I mean, especially for these communities whose livelihood depends on the health of the ocean.
Yes.
That's how they not only live, but make their living.
Yes. 60% of people in the Philippines depend on coastal resources for food security.
Wow. So you can understand why people are illegally fishing.
Oh, of course.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's just such a...
And this is why, when we think about what's a climate change story, and I've had people come to go, climate change, it's so big. I don't know. How do I do a story about climate change? You know, because we all know who's responsible. We know who's responsible. It's not a mystery. The fossil fuel companies are responsible. Right here in this area, Chevron is the leading emitter of greenhouse gases. They're like 15 miles from here. We know exactly who's responsible. So we actually know what's happening. We know what's happening on the earth. So how do we do those stories? And actually, all these examples, but Sarah's a good one right here. So basically, you have this incredible community out there fighting to retain their fish. One of the things that's been happening as a result of the climatic disruptions that earlier people, callers talked about, is the warming of the ocean. The warming of the ocean is putting incredible stress on the whole marine ecology and the populations of fish, which are shifting, which is increasing the tension on the kind of international, where fishing vessels are going to get their fish, which means they're intruding on areas that are preserved in the Philippines as well as elsewhere in the world. And so, in a way, there are both ends of this process here. One, you have the extreme distress on the ocean. But two, you have this story emerging in the Philippines of people who are actually taking upon themselves to protect what they can of those preserves. So that is a climate story. That is the story of our time,
right?
Our efforts to deal with the trauma on the one hand and the response to be able to survive that trauma on the other.
And it's also amazing to read about resiliency, mm-hmm. right? And so I'm sure if you go back to this place in a year, if these women have been successful, you'll probably see some major change.
Yeah, I mean, Evelyn Malachi, who we followed, talks about exactly that, that there actually are fish in the sanctuary now, where 10 years or 5 years ago there weren't.
Can you talk just for one or two more minutes about these women? Where are they getting their resources, their support? What are their plans over the next year?
Yeah, so they work with a nonprofit, the Coastal Conservation Education Foundation, I believe it's called, that's based in Cebu. They get a lot of technical support, some funding from them. But yeah, they're very under-resourced. They're doing what they can with what little they have. And they've been doing it for a while. I think the Maite Sanctuary, which is where Evelyn is located, has been around for not quite 10 years, but there's others that are like 2 years old that are, they have seen success in that little amount of time.
And I understand you're still shopping the story around?
I am still shopping the story around.
All right.
Yes.
Well, before we end, I want to ask you all about that, just what it takes to place these stories, because that's really important. And I just looked at the clock. We've got about 5 minutes left, so I want to make sure we have time for Nisha. Nisha, you went to Panama to report on a woman rancher pursuing pastoral ranch practices and raising cattle. And I understand that being a woman rancher in Panama is pretty rare. Is that right?
Yes, this particular woman, her name is Orielka Solis, actually inherited her farm from her when her father passed away when she was a teen. Our story takes place in this region called the Azuera region. It's about a four-hour drive west of Panama City. It's known as the cultural heart and agricultural center of Panama. The problem is with this region, when the Spaniards came and wheat didn't really work out in that ecosystem, cattle really was a commodity and has been the commodity, the main commodity for about 500 years. And so the practice of chopping down trees and getting rid of local biodiversity is kind of hand in hand with when you get the farm, that's what you're expected to do. In fact, when a farm has too much growth, it's called a widow. Widower's farm, meaning that the man has passed away who is no longer there and the woman can't maintain the farm. The practice that the farmer that myself and a classmate, Erin Banks Resby, followed, she did the written portion and I the video portion, is called silvopastoral, which is a very interesting scientific term where it basically means the replanting of native shrubs and trees into a landscape, which, as I've already mentioned, is seen as extremely taboo, with her gender also keeping in mind they're wondering what she's doing, in hopes of reestablishing shade for the cattle, trying to restore local biodiversity. And I think the most important part is that when these agricultural plots have been stripped of their natural vegetation and they're submitted, you know, pesticides are actually applied every year. Adding shrubs and trees can actually improve the soil health and allow the soil to actually sequester carbon once again. So what I was really struck by on more of a scientific level is that the soil was actually being healed and you're able to kind of prevent more greenhouse gases from being released. We spent about a week on the ground with Orielka. It's very time intensive to maintain a silvopastoral approach, you know, having trees and shrubs and maintaining them. She works every day. She's a mom. She was also running for local political office, truly a force of nature. Mm. And, you know, what we learned is that she wasn't immediately sold on the idea of planting trees and shrubs. First, just in her local town, it wasn't seen as the appropriate thing to do, but also it actually is a small investment when you first buy the trees and shrubs. But we actually found that it wasn't just ecologically stable, but you actually get much more productive land per hectare. So she actually makes a profit from being more sustainable. I felt very connected with Orielka because I thought if she can do this, given all of the challenges, you know, what is something that I myself can do? I feel so powerless, but here she is doing this every day.
Hmm. How did you find her and why did you decide to go to Panama?
It was actually quite by accident. I've always been interested in agroforestry issues. I feel that the issue of cattle gets a really bad rap and understandably so, but there are many people and people of color who are across the globe who cannot afford to get rid of their farm, you know, can afford to immediately go vegan. And so here's a peninsula that, you know, the U.S. is actually a main buyer of most of the agricultural exports in Panama. no fault of their own, that they don't necessarily get good prices for it, but they still have to keep going on because their families have always been in it. So I love this story because of the way in which it shows someone making do with what they have in the hopes of maybe they don't have to be in the cattle ranching industry anymore. We heard about there's a project similarly in Colombia, but it was just in terms of access and also making sure that they were comfortable with us coming and we're just parachuting in and being like, hey, I want to publish this story. It was more of like, hey, do you want to cooperate with us and show us a little bit of your life, you know, as much as we can see.
And you're also trying to get a place that will publish your piece?
Yes, we have a video and a written piece. We're shopping.
We have about 2 minutes left. Can we just talk about this for a minute? It takes so much time to do these pieces. I mean, you're flying somewhere. You have to pay for your accommodations, your food, 5 days or more. A lot of work goes into these pieces. And the pay when you're a freelancer is very, very low. In fact, someone on Twitter said it's almost the same price they paid decades ago, that the fee has not gone up. So are you all hoping to actually work for an outlet where you can do this kind of reporting? Or are you planning to be freelancers? Just quickly.
My plan, this is Sarah, is to be a freelancer. I feel like the only way these days to do this, to report on the stories that you want to write about, is to freelance if you aren't hiring.
Yeah. And I'm a more traditional outlet kind of girl. I'm currently working as a reporter at the Investigative Reporting Program. And certainly for investigative reporting, there's this trend of nonprofits that fund a long-term investigation and then you build a partner to then publish. So to me, that feels like the right outlet.
Freelancing, same here, working on the subject and hoping that it can not only be a resource for media outlets, but research institutes for the broader public.
And I think the School of Journalism gives these journalists and others in our class the chance to do these, to understand the basic processes that are necessary to do these kind of stories and get those skills when they're out there freelancing. They can get this stuff out there. Mm-hmm. And it's a dynamic world. There are opportunities they know about that I don't even know about, but they're there.
Yeah.
And I have complete faith they'll be out there. We're able to support this class with some grants, which really helps.
Well, and it's such important work. So thank you all so much for joining us. And again, once these stories are published, we will let you know about it because a couple of people have called in and said, where can I read these?
Outstanding.
Mark Shapiro is a lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. And we've also been joined today by three students who are also Earth journalists, Sarah Trent, Allison Stamos, and Nisha Ballroom. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rose.
Thanks to Malihei Razazan for producing today's show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls One Planet series.